from KXJZ in Sacramento. This is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Later in the program, actor Mitch Agris. He's playing Galileo on stage soon in Sacramento. He's well known to many in Sacramento from years ago as Captain Mitch. Also, big changes in California birth rates. Why is it happening and what does it mean? But first, for 10 years now, a cluster of tiny homes near the railroad in downtown Sacramento have been helping homeless people back on their feet. They're known as the Quinn Cottages, a supportive housing project that claims a graduation rate of nearly 90%. The project director of Quinn Cottages is himself a former resident. He's David Husett, and he joins us along with a current resident, Sheila Clough. David, Sheila, welcome to Insight.
Thank you for having us.
David, who gets to stay at Quinn Cottages?
Well, it's people that stay there are coming off the streets, so they're basically people that have through no fault of their own, sometimes have become homeless. They work with another agency, whether it's a shelter or a recovery home. The people then go through there. They call Quinn Cottages to get an application, fill out an application, and the process starts from there.
Who doesn't get to stay there?
Well, basically, the criteria for Quinn Cottages is they've got to be over 18, they've got to be homeless, and then after that, it's kind of wide open.
What about people who have serious challenges or problems of one kind or another, drugs, alcohol, that sort of thing?
Yeah, we take everybody from that have mental, as long as they have the need for the program, and they, through accommodations of ours, they can maintain a cottage, could attend groups, and move forward in the process within the program. Drugs and alcohol is not a problem. About 80% of our people have drug and alcohol problems. About 30% of them have mental health issues. And the rest of them are homeless.
When did you live there?
Well, I was I graduated from the program in May of 01. So I was homeless on the streets prior to getting into Quinn Cottages.
How long were you on the streets?
Well, it's kind of before I went to the streets, I went to prison. Mm. So went to prison, decided that prison was not for me, but didn't know how to do anything differently. Thought that my plan was I just need to commit crimes, but don't tell anybody. You know, that was my plan.
Didn't work out, I guess.
Didn't work out. 80 days later, I was back in prison. This time I decided that, you know, I didn't want to live that way. So I reached out for help and went to California Rehabilitation Center in Norco, where I got help for my addictions, which was, you know, methamphetamine and alcohol. Got out, went to a recovery program in Citrus Heights and heard about Quinn Cottages. And that's when I started the application and got in then.
How long did you stay there?
Well, I stayed there for about 15 months. The average length of stay for our program is you can stay up to 2 years. Right now, the average length of stay is roughly 14 to 15 months is when people are getting out of there.
When you were on the streets before you went to Quinn, could you have seen yourself today as being the project director of something like that?
No, I think when you're on the streets, you don't see anything. I think you're silenced by your homelessness. You see nothing but what's in front of you, which is just desperation. Nothing. You're so deep in the hole, your self-esteem is shot. You have no skills. I had no driver's license. I had no friends. I had no credit. I was a convicted felon. That's what your future is. You don't see past that. At that point, I was living day by day. If I could just make it to the next day, I thought that was going to be something great.
David Husett, project director of Quinn Cottages in downtown Sacramento. Sheila Clough, you've been living at Quinn since August, right?
Yes, I have.
What was it like your first night there?
It was kind of weird. I had just come from a residential treatment program that I had been in for 15 months, and there was 27 women. So going from 27 women to being in your own cottage was kind of weird for me. It took me a minute to go to sleep.
How long had you been on the streets?
Like I said, I came from a residential treatment program. So I had the opportunity to transition into Quinn Cottages.
But before that?
I was in prison.
You're in prison.
Yes.
How did you handle that first night then? You said it was different. You'd been in institutional situations before that, and here you are closing the door.
Yes, it was weird. But a lot of support. I used my cell phone a lot to call people to help me get through the night. It was nice.
What kind of support? What exactly is available to you as someone who lives at Quinn Cottages?
Well, we're a big community, and so there's a lot of people around that I am able to go knock on the door or even call from house to house, you know, looking for some support. Anything that I need, you know, they're there. So that's the kind of support I'm talking about, whether it be a conversation, you know, if you need a hug, you know, just someone to talk to. It's a lot of support in Quinn Cottages.
David, what are the rules?
Well, basically, the rules are you could stay there as long as you need the services and you're willing to access them. So the difference between our program and others is they're the participant. We call them participants, not residents, because they don't reside there. They participate there, and that's the key to it. They will attend groups, and they will come in, and they will work on their own goal plan and their own wellness plan. So whatever that is for them, we're a program that's really unique in that we don't tell anybody what to do, have a minimum amount of groups they need to go to. What we say is there are causes to homelessness, and when you're out there looking for a place to sleep, looking for food, that's a full-time job. So what we ask is why you're a Quinn, you turn the opposite in, is looking to redo your life, gain some skills back as full-time work. So whatever that is for you, as long as you're moving forward, you know, you could stay there for up to the 2 years.
I'm sure that there are some people who, for whatever reason, just can't or won't make it. Do you screen those people out if they come knocking on the door?
No, because who am I to say or screen out? You know, it's real hard for me to look at you and say, well, you know what, you might not make it. Because I'll tell you, this is a disease we're dealing with here. Drug and alcohol addiction, a disease. It crosses all barriers. It affects everybody. So basically, as long as you're eligible, which is it's through HUD's criteria of being homeless, you're homeless, and you're referred by another agency, it's participant driven. So you will go before participants of the program who will ask you questions as to why you want to live there, what are you going to bring to the Quinn community, and not so much what you're going to bring, what are you going to give back to the Sacramento community at large. So part of living there is community service. So while we're homeless folks, we're also going over to Lowe's and Fish's, which is just right across the street from us, and giving back to the community, because we realize in the program, as well at Quinn, you can't keep what you don't give away.
Yeah. Quinn Cottages are 10 years old this month. There's a graduation ceremony tomorrow. Sheila, what's daily life like? Could you give us an example of what it's like to live at Quinn Cottages?
Well, for me, I get up every morning and I go to school. I'm going to school to get my GED. And then after that, I come home and I go to groups at the house. We have all kind of different groups, from living skills to meetings, women's groups, men groups. It's a lot of them. And they're really, really good for you, especially if you're looking for a way out or trying to learn different skills in life, you know. And then after that, you know, I can either go back to my cottage. We have a computer room, so I'd like to get on the computer.
Is there much social life there? Do people hang out much with each other?
Yes. Every Thursday we have a community meal, and it's where the participants in the community come to the pavilion, and each quad is assigned a Thursday to cook. And so we all gather up and we all eat and talk about what's going on in our community. But other than that, we all have an outside seating where people sit outside and chat.
What if someone starts causing trouble? How does that get dealt with at first?
Well, me personally, I haven't seen any of that.
You haven't seen any? Good.
No,
okay,
I have not.
David, what happens? At the lowest level, what's the first thing that happens?
Lowest level, what's great about our program is what happens is they will go before their peers. We have a resident, we have a peer panel that's all made up of participants of the program. So say, for instance, I may have had a relapse, or I'm not progressing forward, or I'm not doing any groups at all, no participation. I'm just living there because I want to pay $18 a month because it's based on your rent. The participants are saying, hey, you know what, you know, you're not participating. You go before the peer panel where you'll state your case and they'll say what their recommendations are. Either they're going to support you in your efforts to move forward, or they're going to say they're not going to support you. And then we will work with you to transition from our program, because, you know, Quinn's not for everybody. There's no question about it. Some people either make it or not, and some people, they need more structure or a different type of program to get their lives together, and Quinn's not you know, strictly for them. But it's up to the participants to run that.
Presumably, some of the people who are at Quinn Cottages have buddies who they know from the streets, but who are not in Quinn Cottages and maybe have no desire to go there. Do they hang around?
Well, we're a gated community, and which is this. Our participants aren't locked in. You're locked out, more or less. The gate swings one way. In order to come to our program, number one, it's you ring a bell. If I wanted to see Sheila, I'd have to know where Sheila lived, what cottage she lived in. Sheila's got to come up. They got to leave ID. And it's participant. We have a participant that's doing an internship at the front desk, hospitality clerk. We'll look at the person coming in, and if they've got to be clean for 30 days even to visit. And we'll know, and during these one-on-one sessions that we have with our participants, we discuss the importance of having friends that are in sobriety, or that are clean and sober, that are trying to do the right thing. And we say you're only good as your support group. So this is something that what's great is the participants call them on it. We can't see everything. They'll say, hey, I saw your friend come over, and they didn't look so hot. And they'll say, well, they just, you know, and that's kind of how it goes.
Yeah. Sheila, you currently live there. You're a participant at Quinn Cottages. Could you describe your cottage so we know what it looks like?
When you first walk in, to the left of you, it's like the little living area where you could set up a couch, a TV. And then farther to the left, there's a door. It's a double door, and in there would be your room. Now, if I was outside the door again, to the right would be the bathroom, and straight ahead would be the kitchen. So it's nice and comfy. It's made for one person or a person and a child. So it's not huge, but it's big enough for me.
Who furnishes it?
We do. It comes with a bed, but through donations or whatever else, you know, you can get your TV or a couch or whatever.
And what does it look like from the outside?
Oh, they're really nice.
Yeah?
Really nice, yes. You have a chance to grow some grass or plant a garden or something of that nature.
Sounds good. Is it noisy with the railroad nearby?
It can be. It can be.
Yeah. David, I was reading stories from the Sacramento Bee from 10 years ago when this started up. And the Bee described it in their editorial pages as, quote, a social service experiment. And they noted that there were a lot of skeptics about this program, that maybe this was rewarding people who had criminal backgrounds, abusing drugs and alcohol, with a nice place to stay. And this was already a part of town. This is north downtown with already a lot of homeless and could be just a magnet. How would you evaluate the state of things today?
Well, I can tell you in the 10 years since its inception, the program has changed completely. And part of that, and big part of that, is our executive director, Robert Tobin, who's a visionary. And he's put into place a system and the way things run there that is, it's participant-driven. It's based on strength-based program. We truly believe everybody has resiliency to bounce back from any issues they have. I think we've definitely brought some value to the downtown area. You know, everybody was, you get a lot of that not in my backyard, you know, when you're trying to do a program like this. And what we do is we've cleaned up the downtown because our participants give back. So I think that this is, we had a graduation rate when it first opened. We had some bumps and grinds in the road. I believe it was 30% of the people that graduated.
I was going to ask you about that because I'm looking at this chart. It says 98 was 33%, then 35%, 38%. And nowadays it's up in the 80s.
So about 87%.
So what's so different now?
Well, what we did is early on, when it first was going on, is again, drugs and alcohol were a problem. The participants came to staff and said, "Look, this is getting crazy." There was about, out of the 60 cottages, I believe a quarter of them were full. There was prostitution going on. So all the things that they were thinking about what happened did happen.
And so, you were probably there at that time.
No, I wasn't there.
Not quite.
I was in Folsom then.
Oh.
No, wasn't there. Wasn't there. I didn't even hear about it. But so the participants said, "Look, you need to start testing people." So they decided to take charge or empower themselves to go around. And so we started to have drug testing there, which alleviated a lot of it. And then we put things in place where we added early on, there wasn't hardly any groups. And the problem is not just giving someone a house. Okay, that's not going to cure homelessness. I mean, because it took a while to lose your house. So you've got to work on the reasons that cause you to be homeless. Okay, you know, it's just like anything else. Just giving somebody, that's why for people that have alcohol problems, stopping drinking is not the answer. I mean, because the alcohol is just a symptom of what's really going on. So by giving someone a house without attaching wraparound services, we've added more groups. We've added more participant-driven strategies. We've added that the resident council, the peer panel. So basically, by empowering them, they pretty much police themselves, thus increasing the graduation rate by what it is today.
What does graduation rate mean?
Graduation from Quinn Cottages is they graduate with sobriety intact, permanent housing, and steady income. Now, that could be either employment or mainstream entitlement benefits. It's because a lot of people come in SSI eligible, but they can't get stabilized to get someone in. So we have someone that comes and works with them so they get the benefits that they're entitled to.
And how much tracking do you do of people after they've gone?
Well, we have a pretty big alumni association. We've had roughly in the last 10 years about 546 participants that have gone through the program. We have an alumni, a list of about 220 people. So a little less than half of who we're actually in touch with on a, you know, on a monthly basis. It's real hard to, you know, once people leave, because people will move out of the area. We try our best or can, at least for the first year, to track these numbers to find out how they are doing, because that's true success. Mm-hmm. How are they doing a year after they left?
And Sheila, do you feel like you're getting a handle on the causes of your earlier problems?
Yes, I do believe I am.
Yeah. And do you feel like Quinn Cottages, staying at Quinn Cottages, is reinforcing that?
Yes, I do. Yeah. I do.
Okay. How long do you think you'll be there?
Well, I'd like to say I'd try and hit the 15-month mark, or yeah, if not, a little less than that.
So that would be about the end of next year?
Yes.
Okay. Well, good luck to you.
Well, thank you.
And David, thanks so much.
Oh, thank you. If I could just mention one thing before we leave. We are having our Christmas card fundraiser, and these Christmas cards are made by participants. They're on our website, which is www.cottagehousing.org. You'll see the participants who, you'll see a little blurb about them. And again, tomorrow night from 4 to 6 is our graduation 10-year ceremony. We'll be having Bishop Francis Quinn, who is the namesake, will be there speaking. And he's just back in town from many years in the Arizona desert helping Indians in a motorhome.
Wow, my goodness. Interesting man in himself, yeah. But that's another topic.
Yeah, yeah. Get him on here.
Yeah. David Husad, Project Director at Quinn Cottages, and Sheila Clough, a current participant there. Thank you both so much.
Thank you for having us.
You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. Coming up, actor Mitch Agris. We'll be right back. You're listening to Inside from KXJZ. I'm Jeffrey Callison. A play about Galileo opens this Saturday in Sacramento. It's called The Starry Messenger. The playwright was the prolific Rick Foster of Sonora. We'll talk with him a little later. But first, the man who plays Galileo, actor Mitch Agris. He's worked on stage and TV around the country and with many big names for many decades. In Sacramento, though, he's well known to thousands of people of a certain age as a sailor on local children's TV called first Captain Delta and then Captain Mitch. He's in our studio. Mitch Agris, welcome to Insight.
Thank you for having me.
How did you get started as a sailor on TV?
Oh, well, that's funny because it started with Shakespeare, of all things. Now, I was working at the American Shakespeare Festival in Stratford, Connecticut, and I was also moderating their academy. And so they wanted someone at a television station in New Haven.
This is the late 50s, isn't it?
This is, well, yeah, this was in 1956, 7, 8, that area. Yeah. And so I was chosen to go have an interview about the academy. And when I went there, the television station looked at me and said, "We need somebody for Popeye cartoons." So that's how it started. And I did it for a couple of years there. And then returned to the festival and eventually ended up doing cartoon shows here in Sacramento.
Did you have a beard at that time?
Yes, I did. It was kind of auburn red. It wasn't white.
Now, you were doing Shakespeare at the time. Did you just see this as it's just a little thing you were going to do to tide you over a certain time?
I did think it might do that, and then I discovered that it worked very well, and after I did it for 2 years, then I went back with the festival for a tour, and then discovered that really my career was not going anywhere big, and I had done well with this television thing, and they needed people, and they needed somebody in Sacramento, and I was recommended, and so I decided to make the shift in my career.
But you were living a long way away from Sacramento at that time. Were they advertising for someone?
No, but they had a very, there was a network of sales representatives and people like that, and so when this kind of thing was needed, people all over the country were aware. They were communicating back and forth, and somehow or other my name had gotten recommended, and I came out, met the people, and that was the time I shifted my life to Sacramento and California.
How did you get started? How and where did you get started in the theater?
In high school, actually, yes. And then I studied for one summer at the State University of Iowa while I was in high school to see if I was really interested in it. Somebody in my English teacher in high school was the one who was recommending me, and he recommended that I apply for the drama department at the Carnegie Institute of Technology.
Which is now Carnegie Mellon.
Carnegie Mellon.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And I was accepted there, and so I studied there for 4 years and graduated. Wonderful, wonderful experience. And then had some little lucky things happen, which kept me busy for several years before I made the big shift.
You worked with over the years with many well-known people, and one that stands out for me is you worked on stage and under the direction of the playwright Thornton Wilder. You were in one of his plays, and he was acting in it and directing it, wasn't he?
Well, he didn't direct it, but he was acting in it. He enjoyed doing his plays, and either Our Town or, in this case, The Skin of Our Teeth. And in summer stock, he would often go about and perform in his plays, and I was fortunate enough to be a member of the company, of a summer stock company that he visited, and that was one of the thrills of my early life.
I bet. Mm-hmm. And let's see, you also acted in a play with Katharine Hepburn.
Well, I was a member of the American Shakespeare Festival company under John Houseman during the late 50s, and she appeared there. And so one of the productions was Much Ado About Nothing. I was cast in it, and we also toured in it. And so I have some fine memories, but they're not the sort of things you want to go into now because we have other things to emphasize on this program.
Well, that's okay. People are interested to know more about you about the play Galileo. My guest is Mitch Agris. He plays Galileo in a stage production of The Starry Messenger, opening this Saturday at California Stage. I want to ask you about another well-known actor that you worked with in the past, and he apparently gave you some advice, Jack Klugman.
Oh, yes. Well, that's an interesting little story. I was in the military. I was stationed in Biloxi, Mississippi, Keesler Air Force Base, Air Corps Base at that time. And in my company was a fellow named Sam Klugman, who said to me, "You go to drama school. I have a brother who's hanging around the streets of Philadelphia who thinks he might want to be an actor. Do you have any advice for him?" And I said, "Well, he's not far from Pittsburgh, where Carnegie Institute of Technology has their famed drama department. Why doesn't he go and apply?" And then when I came out of the military and returned for my final year and a half at school, Jack Klugman was there. And he has told people in public that he attributes his being an actor to my having recommended that he go to that drama school.
And he came and visited you.
Oh, yeah, he did on my program here. He was here for another event some years back. So he came on and we chatted and he watched me carry on in my daily way.
Yes. And another longtime favorite of mine who you were acquainted with, Jerry Stiller. Tell us about Jerry Stiller.
Oh, well, Jerry Stiller did about two or three plays with him. But very early on, we were in a play called The Clandestine Marriage, which is one of the old classics. And the thing I remember first about Jerry, he was very serious, studying, method acting. And we had trouble getting to come on stage in time for his cue during rehearsals. He spent so much time preparing off stage. And I thought, oh, if he's going to be this difficult, my goodness. Turned out that he ended up being pretty successful at what he and his wife did.
and his persona is this real sort of fiery, spontaneous guy, but you saw a different side of him.
Oh, yeah, I saw his serious side. Yes, and he really took it very seriously, but he ended up going in a somewhat different direction, and that then became an improv thing with him, which, of course, is also serious acting as well.
Mm. Now, when you came to Sacramento, you started out on TV as Captain Delta, not Captain Mitch.
Right.
Why did the name change?
Oh,
because it was the same character.
Oh, yes, essentially. I was working at Channel 13 and had chosen, after a change in ownership, that I had chosen to shift to another television station. And when I shifted, The name that had been developed as Captain Delta at Channel 13 in those days, they claimed the ownership to it. So when I shifted to another station, which was when Channel 40 went on the air in 1968 as an independent television station, I was not able to use the name. And so we developed my own name and said, nobody can steal that from me. And so that's how, and then I spent much more of my time and many more years at Channel 40 than I ever did at Channel 13.
And you also worked for shorter periods at Channel 19 and Channel 58. So
Yes.
All told, many years as Captain Delta.
So about 30, Jeff. 30
My
years,
goodness.
Can you believe it? I have a little joke that I say. I say that, you know, that I've outlived the era for which I was born 30 years too soon.
So many people have noted to me, you know, oh, isn't he Captain Mitch coming on Insight? And in fact, David Husett, who was in our earlier segment of the program, when he figured out who you were, he was all excited about it. What is it like after all this time being the source of so many fond memories for so many people?
It's very gratifying because it means that what I was doing was genuine, which is what I had intended it to be. It was not one of these frenetic jump around, ha ha ha, you know, get the little kiddies to jump and laugh and carry on. I approached it quite differently, and it was really an extension of my theatrical disciplines. And so I was able to maintain this character with some sincerity over the years. And and had no idea, by the way, that it was reaching out to such a large audience throughout this part of California or the area, the whole region. So it's nice. It really is to have people have warm feelings to know that you had a pleasant enough influence,
sure,
even though it was just cartoons after all.
And yet many actors try hard to avoid being typecast. Did you ever feel like you were being typecast as Captain Mitch?
No. As a matter of fact, I wanted that to be very consistent. I wanted them when they listened to me or watched me or talked to me in public, that they were talking to the same person that they felt they had seen. I wanted that to be true.
Well, I was going to ask you about that because there must be a special responsibility when you are a TV personality for children, because when you're out at the supermarket or pumping gas, then for a lot of people, you're still Captain Mitch.
Well, they would come up, and I'm always surprised in the hardware stores and places like that. And so it was easier not to be putting on anything. It was just the way I felt. It was honest because I didn't have any. I was not really trying to put on anything. I was just trying to give a pleasant, entertaining persona.
You did very little theater when you were on TV as Captain Delta and Captain Mitch, but then you got back into theater really Captain Mitch to sleep.
Yeah, it was almost 20 to 30 years, and then I went back to my first career, my first love, when I left after the television, which took so much of my time, a lot of public appearances and so forth. There really wasn't time for anything else. I loved it. I'm glad to be back at doing it.
And it was through the bus fields at the B Street Theater, wasn't it?
Yes, yes.
What happened?
Well, they were doing a production of Sam Shepard's Fool for Love in about 1992, and Tim Busfield was performing in it, and they wanted somebody for that grumpy old father, that grouch of a strange, difficult man. And somebody said, why don't you get a hold of him and see? He has a background. And so I met them, joined up with them, and so over the years I've done about 9 or 10 productions at the B Street, which I love.
Yes. Mitch Agris, actor who plays Galileo in a stage production of The Starry Messenger, opening this Saturday at California Stage. Now, the playwright who wrote The Starry Messenger is Rick Foster. He joins us by phone from Sonora. Rick, welcome back to Insight.
Thanks, Jeffrey. Thanks very much.
Tell us, why did you decide to write a play primarily for children about Galileo?
Well, I've been writing plays for school tours for the last 10 or 12 years. I started when I was a playwright in residence at Sierra Rep, and mostly I've concentrated on California history, cultural conflict, and so forth. But both I and the man who co-founded Duende, my company up here in Sonora, with me, Tom McGuire, have backgrounds in science. And so just even though we've long passed science and engineering and mathematics in my case, the desire to do something about that lingered. And Galileo is trials, literally trials before the Inquisition, are in some ways quite reminiscent of the conflicts going on in society today between creationists and evolutionists, and the difference between the authoritarian and the empirical view of what's true about the natural world. So it seemed to be something that both spoke to my past and Tom McGuire's past, who played Galileo when we did it here, and to you know, contemporary life, and it fit in well with the curriculum for the fifth and the seventh grade. So there were both practical and personal reasons driving the choice.
What do you hope that the children, especially who see the play, take away from it?
I hope they'll take away from it several things. One is that there's a lot of science presented, very graphically acted out, so to speak, and so some of the principal laws that Galileo discovered, was the first to, you know, quantify, are presented, and then the exciting history of his astronomical discoveries. I mean, he saw things that nobody had ever seen before. He saw that there are millions of stars in the sky and not just the few thousands we see. He saw there are moons around Jupiter, and he saw that the moon itself is not a perfect smooth billiard ball but covered with mountains, and all of these things were highly controversial in his time. So I want them to understand some of that, but mostly I want them really to understand what a scientific attitude is like. So I make Galileo face posthumously one of his greatest failings, so to speak, something that he thought and dearly wanted to believe is true about how the tides were formed, and it turns out he was totally up the pole, and he has to come to terms with that in a way that is exemplary for a scientific person to do. Mm-hmm. And his treasured belief turns out to be wrong, and that attitude towards truth is at least as important as any of the facts that we present. And I want them to just to have a good time, to have really enjoyed and laughed and felt some tension when he's being tried by the Inquisition, and rejoice with him and the relationship he has with his daughter, Sister Maria Celeste.
Mitch, you play Galileo, an iconic figure, if ever there was one. What's it like playing Galileo?
Well, to me, it's a romp, to tell you the truth, because he is enjoying so much, realizing at last that his discoveries have been recognized by the world long after his death, and so and also to be demonstrating them in a rather dramatic way. For youngsters, for young people who are studying these things, and I just, I think it's just plain fun. Fun.
Yeah, Mitch brings up something that maybe we should point out. The play takes place now, in 2007 or in 2008, starting in January, when Maria Celeste brings him back to Earth.
That's his daughter, who's a nun.
This is the daughter, who's a nun, right. And, of course, they've both been dead for more than 350 years, but the conceit of the play is that Galileo was so depressed when he died that he thought all of his discoveries would have been destroyed by the Inquisition, all of his books burned, and his work forgotten. And so she brings him back so that she can get the children of today to convince him that the whole world knows that the Earth does move around the sun, and that his work wasn't in vain. And so the play begins with her getting the kids to do that, and with him coming out of his posthumous coma and becoming fully alive in the world again.
Mitch, you have a reading from the play for us. Where about are we in the play?
Well, there's a little section here in which it's demonstrated that he has discovered that Venus is really a planet moving around the sun. And by extension, therefore, has discovered that the Earth is also a planet moving around the sun. And he does this with a little demonstration with his daughter, who impersonates the sun, holding a long stick with a ball at the end of it, which is Venus. And she circles around, and as she does it, he says these things.
Okay.
He says, "You see, she's the sun. All the light comes from her. The ball is Venus. Venus has no light of its own, so the part that faces the sun is bright. The other part is just too dark to see. Sometimes we can't see Venus because she's between us and the sun. She's all dark and swallowed in sunlight. Then she moves just far enough away that we can see her after sunset. See, there's a narrow crescent. Now, as she swings more, she seems to move farther away from the sun, and the bright part gets thicker, like the moon. Pretty soon, Venus makes a half-moon shape like our moon. But see, although she's half bright now, she's farther away from the Earth. But even so, she keeps getting rounder as she's getting smaller. You see, she's moving around behind the sun. She's on the other side of the sun. She's so close, she's become so perfect of a circle that she's so close behind the sun, you can't see her anymore. But pretty soon, she comes out on the other side of the sun. So instead of seeing her after sunset, you begin to see her before sunrise. And she keeps on moving till she becomes a crescent again, passes in front of the sun, and back to here. She is moving around the sun.
Oh, that is wonderful. That is great. That's Mitch Agris reading his role of Galileo in a new production of the fairly recent play, The Starry Messenger, written by our other guest, Rick Foster. He's on the phone. It opens this Saturday at California Stage, runs through December 16th, and then in January is going to be touring schools in the Sacramento area. Rick, before we wrap this up, I do want to ask you a quick question about a very well-known play of yours, Vivian, which has been around for many years. And tell us what's next for Vivian.
Well, Vivian will be at Sacramento Theater Company opening at the middle of next month. I don't remember the exact day, but it's mm-hmm. Maybe it's the Saturday or the Thursday. Anyway,
yes.
You can look it up at Sacramento. It starts its previews, I believe, on December 12th.
Yes.
And it's with Jana Stevens, who performed the play at California Stage in 2000 and hasn't been seen in Sacramento area since then. So we're really, really very happy to be doing it in mm-hmm. Sacramento Theater Company, and it will immediately go, after it closes there January 6th, to Philadelphia, where it opens on January 16th at the Walnut Street Theater.
Still with Janice,
yeah.
Great.
I've kept the play from anybody else because it's really her. I can't imagine somebody else doing it the way she does it, and the way she does it is getting better every time.
I can imagine. Well, thanks so much. Again, The Starry Messenger, it opens on Saturday at California Stage. My guests, Rick Foster on the phone, the playwright, and in our studio, Mitch Agris, the actor who plays Galileo. Thank you both very much.
Oh, thank you, Jeffrey.
Big pleasure.
Bye, Mitch.
You. You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. Coming up, big changes in California birth rates. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. I'm Jeffrey Callison. You can download previous editions of Insight. Find them at capradio.org/insight. Birth rates in California are changing significantly. Teen rates are falling. Over 40 rates are rising. Why is this happening and what does it mean? All this was the subject of a recent report by the Public Policy Institute of California. The author of Birth Rates in California is PPIC Associate Director of Research and Senior Fellow Hans Johnson. He's based in San Francisco, but was in Sacramento today to give a talk on this topic. Hans, welcome back to the program.
Oh, thanks for having me, Jeffrey.
Let's start with the teen birth rates. What kind of change are we seeing?
Well, you know, this is really good news. Teen birth rates are the subject of a lot of policy concern and public program interventions. And in California, what we've seen over the last 15 years is that teen birth rates have fallen by half. So we've had a 50% reduction in the last 15 years. And that's good for a number of reasons. We think that teen births aren't good for the mothers themselves. And certainly we know that children that are born to teen mothers have worse outcomes on a number of different measures, whether it's criminal activity later in life, whether it's being abused and ending up in foster care. So discouraging teen pregnancy is an important part of public policy, and it's one in California where we seem to be having some success.
Do we know why the birth rate among teens has fallen so much?
Yeah, well, there are different ways of kind of thinking about why. So one is the most immediate reason why, and is are teens having less sex, or are they having more protected sex? And the answer seems to be that they tend to be having more protected sex rather than less sex. But then we might think of kind of wider reasons, like why would teens not want to have children now, whereas before some teens would have wanted to have children. Of course, remember, most teens, of course, don't have children. And there we see, I think, a lot of different reasons perhaps coming into play. I think public education and some of the programs we have in California, which have been rated very highly by advocates for sex education like the Guttmacher Institute, have played a role. And so, for example, in California, we require schools to teach sex education, and we require that sex education include information on contraceptives as well as abstinence. Whereas in some other states, for example, Texas, which now has the highest teen pregnancy rates in the nation, their programs, first of all, don't require that schools teach about sex education. And if they do in Texas, they have to focus on abstinence.
Mm. Now, welfare policies have changed as well, especially in the 90s. Have those changes affected the teen birth rate?
It's a really good question. I think that they might have played a role, but I suspect it's a minor role. And the reason I say that is when we look at changes in teen birth rates over time, we see that these declines in California really began before welfare reform, and they were pretty strong declines before welfare reform. They continued through welfare reform, and they have continued since then, since most of the enforcement mechanisms of welfare reform have come into play. We've still seen continued declines. We see it across broad categories of people, across different race groups. We see it across different counties in the state. So I think that welfare reform might have played a role, but certainly we see a larger trend.
My guest is Hans Johnson, Associate Director and Senior Fellow at the Public Policy Institute of California. He wrote the recent report, Birth Rates in California. His specialties include demographics. He was in Sacramento today to give a talk on birth rates in California. The other headline, I guess, of this study refers to women in their early 40s. The birth rate among them has changed a lot, too.
Yeah, so it's not just women in their early 40s that have seen a big increase, but generally what we've seen is a shifting in the prime ages at which women have children. So we already talked about declines at teen rates, but also women in their 20s are less likely to have children now than 15 years ago. And the big increases have been for women in their 30s and especially women in their early 40s. Now, it's important to keep in mind that the rates are still quite low for women in their early 40s. It's just that they've gone up quite a bit over where they used to be. So, for example, for U.S.-born whites and Asians, the groups that have had the largest age shift in terms of when they have children, birth rates for women in their early 40s have gone up threefold over the last 15 years, an absolutely phenomenal change.
That is a very, very significant change. Do we know why that's happening?
We have good ideas about why that's happening. So there are a number of different things happening all at once. First, economic opportunities for women have continued to improve. College going and college graduation are at all-time highs for women, not for men, but for women. And those are associated with better economic opportunities, higher incomes, which makes having children more difficult when you're young, especially when you're establishing your educational credentials and you're establishing your career. But also we've seen a delayed age at marriage. And marriage, despite what a lot of people think, still matters quite a bit for having children. So we read and hear a lot about non-marital childbearing and rates of non-marital childbearing going up, and they have. But the fact is that the vast majority of women who have children are married, about 70% in California, and they're marrying much later now than they used to. So one of the most amazing statistics to me isn't necessarily the average age at marriage in California. It's 27 now for women. But in 1960, it was actually 20 was the median age at marriage. So that means half of women got married before age 20 and the other half after.
That's a big change in a relatively short
amount of
time.
It's a big change. I mean, I'm more shocked by the getting married when you're 20 in 1960 than getting married when you're 27 today. But yeah, it's a big change in a relatively short period of time. And so it's pushed back. And there's also this whole kind of discussion about people entering adulthood later in life, becoming adults later in life than they used to. Whether that's true or not, I don't know. You could imagine that it might be to some extent. And to a certain extent, then we see it reflected in terms of when people start their families and get married and all those things.
You said earlier it's considered good news that the teen birth rate has fallen so significantly. Is there a good news aspect to women having to the birth rate rising among women who are older?
I think it's good news and bad news to some extent. So I think mostly good news. When you are older, in general, you have more resources, economic resources. You have more maturity. And those are good things for you and especially good things for your child. I would say perhaps there's a not so silver lining to this trend, and that is many women and couples are not able to achieve their goals with respect to family size because they've started so late and it's hard for them to have children. So certainly we have seen a large increase in the number of people who are seeking medical interventions, for example, in trying to achieve their desires with respect to family size. So I guess, you know, that would be something that's a little negative.
Well, that suggests, though, that if the age at which women can conceive and give birth, if that gets pushed higher and higher, then the birth rate among women over 40 could quite reasonably continue to increase.
Yeah, I mean, we see no let-up in that increase. It's a pretty strong increase year after year after year for the last 15 years. And while the data we had to look at this didn't tell us whether the birth was conceived with any sort of medical intervention, we can look at the incidence of multiple births. That's twins and triplets and higher order births. And those births are associated more commonly with medical intervention than what we call singleton births. And to give you an example, in California, in the early 1980s, about 2% of births to women in their early 40s were twins or higher order. Today, it's almost 8%. So that rate of multiple births has skyrocketed. At the same time, we've had these large increases in birth rates among women in their early 40s. That suggests that medical intervention is playing a role.
You touched earlier on race and ethnicity. Is there anything that is significant that you found about a racial or ethnic angle to the birth rate changes?
So we see most of the shift towards older ages occurring primarily among U.S.-born women rather than foreign-born women, and especially among U.S.-born whites and Asians, so that Latinas in particular and African-Americans are still more likely to have children in their 20s and also still have higher teen birth rates. But the biggest decline in teen birth rates has been among African Americans.
And finally, and very quickly, Hans, anything that you would like to see state policymakers take out of your report?
Well, I was pleased earlier today. I did have a chance to talk to some state policymakers. And I think that one of the big challenges that remains in California is that our teen birth rates, while they've come down, are still far higher than in some other states in the U.S. and far higher than in other developed countries. And if we look across the state, we can really identify places where we have some pretty severe problems, and those tend to be inland regions of the state, places like the San Joaquin Valley in particular.
Okay. Hans Johnson of the Public Policy Institute of California wrote the recent report, Birth Rates in California. Hans, thanks so much for talking with us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Insight for today. I'm Jeffrey Callison. For more information about the guests and topics you hear on Insight, go to our webpage, capradio.org/insight. Coming up on KXJZ, newfound wealth has a side effect in China, childhood obesity. Plus, no more camel ads in your favorite glossy magazine. Tobacco company R.J. Reynolds says it's done with print advertising, at least for next year. Those stories and the rest of the day's business news next on Marketplace. Today's associate producer was Linnea Edmire. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones. The senior producer is Jen Picard. Today's engineer, Nick Bruner. And thank you for joining us.